Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, and the common knowledge about Facebook is that it has forever changed the way we connect to one another. The network of our relationships, the very social fabric of our lives, has been expanded to fit more people than ever before. For the first time in human history, our friendships are not dependent on FaceTime or geography or even on direct contact at all. But how much have Facebook and other social networking sites really altered our human social nature? Our next guest argues that there's something fundamental that Facebook can't and hasn't changed, and that is our brains. Robin Dunbar is a professor of evolutionary anthropology at Oxford University and the author now of How Many Friends Does One Person Need? Dunbar's Number and Other Evolutionary Quirks. Professor Dunbar, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Hi there, Brian.
And you've actually posited an answer known as Dunbar's number to the question, how many friends does one person need? What is it?
It's 150, give or take a few anyway. That's the average.
How do you get there?
Well, we actually got it off the back of a little bit of calculation from the relative size of our brains and relative to those of other primates. And if you compare group size and brain size in monkeys and apes as a whole, you get quite a nice relationship. So big brain primates live in big groups. And if you pop us into that equation, you get the number 150. And that sort of sent us scurrying around the world looking at the size of human social organizations and the size of villages and then the size of personal sort of social networks to see how many friends people did have. And this number 150 just kept coming out all the time.
And so some examples from your book about how it keeps recurring. In the army, a company consists of 130 to 150 people. In Neolithic villages in the Middle East, they were 120 to 150. Amish communities split up once they numbered over 150 people. Business management suggests that over 150 people requires a formal hierarchy. The average population for the 20-some tribal societies that still exist is 153. And English villages in Domesday Book by William the Conqueror was about 150 people. So are you saying this is a physical limitation, that our brains are just not big enough to process the details of more than 150 relationships? This is a neocortex thing?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it doesn't mean to say that that's the limit on the number of people you know that you can recognize the face of and put a name to. That's much, much bigger. But the point is, this seems to be the limit on the number of people you can maintain a real personal relationship with. So if you kind of, you know, call them up and said, come on out and have a drink, haven't seen you for ages, the likelihood is they'd say yes. Whereas most of the rest of the folks out there would say, hang on a minute, who on earth are you?
And sure enough, the average user, according to Facebook, has between 120 and 130 friends.
That's right.
So there's your theory on Facebook.
Absolutely bang on. that's just allowing a little room for Granny and Grandpa who aren't on Facebook, on the internet yet.
But since it takes less time to keep up with a friend on Facebook and less time to reinforce those bonds, wouldn't it make sense for your number to be higher in the arena of social network than of, say, a Neolithic village or basic Roman fighting unit?
You might think so, but and indeed, that was actually one of the questions we were asking and why we were interested in what happened on Facebook. Because if the limit is just a time constraint, it's how much time you can spend doing stuff with folks, then something like Facebook should allow you to cut through that and have a bigger social circle. The answer seems to be not. I mean, you can have more people on your Facebook page if you really want to. And of course, many people do. They have perhaps 500 or 600 people. Mm-hmm. But most of those beyond the 150, I kind of describe them as voyeurs onto your little world, as it were. They're not really people you know that well. You just kind of bumped into them somewhere, or you know, there's a professional reason for having them on there. Say, if you're a journalist, for example. But the work we've done on real life social networks really strongly suggests that if you don't in the end get to see these people face to face, those relationships are going to decay, come what may, over time. And gradually those people will bump down and eventually drop off the edge of your 150. You've got to see them at some point, you know, in the flesh, as it were. Now, what Facebook does very nicely is allow you to keep that relationship ticking over when they've kind of gone off to California to work or something like that, so you don't have the chance to see them every week. But sooner or later, you've kind of got to go over there and meet up again.
So, listeners, we're going to open the phones and offer you a chance to weigh in on whether Facebook is a mirror or if it's changed the way you relate to your face-to-face friends. Do you think your reactions with your Facebook friends replicate your face-to-face relationships, or has the site kind of reinvented your friendships? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, our guest, evolutionary anthropologist Robin Dunbar, will stay with us for this call-in. He's the author of How Many Friends Does One Person Need? And he's found that we can only really have a stable relationship of about 150 people, with about 150 people, and this has been stable over time and in many different kinds of groups, as you've been hearing. On Facebook, the average number of friends per person is about 130, about the same as Dunbar's number. So call in and tell us, yes, how your number measures up, whether you think this theory seems to be reflected by your experience, but also qualitatively. Is Facebook a mirror, or has it changed the way you relate to your friends when you are face-to-face? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or, of course, by the way, you can post your comment to our Facebook page at Brian Lehrer Show on the Facebook website. Some people are doing that already. Alexa wrote, "My husband walked by a Facebook friend on the street, said hi, and the friend didn't acknowledge him. Needless to say, my husband unfriended him later that afternoon." From Ellie, "I rarely Facebook interact with real friends. Facebook is for people I do really like but don't run into in the same day-to-day face-to-face circle with. I don't run in the same circle with." So, I don't know, Professor Dunbar, if you want to comment on either of those two, and even the fact that we use friend as a verb now, or in this case, her husband unfriended that guy.
Yes, I like that example. It's very, very nice. But, I mean, the word friend has become kind of, adulterated a little bit, I think, in this context, of course, because Facebook have kind of used that to you know, allow you to identify anybody that you want to put on there. But in reality, if you look at our social networks, the social world you live in, it actually consists of a series of layers of people going out to 150. So all those friends, if you like, within the 150 are not equal. You've got a little close circle of intimate friends of about five, and then a whole series of layers going out. And as you go out through the layers to the 150, so the relationships become less intimate and sort of less important to you, and you spend less time with those people. So going back to that first comment, the second comment, it's those five or ten inner circle friends, that the ones you see every day, the ones that people tend to, you know, sort of find Facebook most useful for, are the people in the outer circles, the outer layer at about 150, because they don't get the chance to see them every day.
So before we take a break and take some calls, there's actually a new social network that is built around your Dunbar's number called Path.
That's absolutely right, yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, the idea, seemingly, is these guys were sort of looking at what was happening on Facebook and looking at the kind of work we'd been doing, and came to the conclusion that there was a space in the market, I suppose, if you like, for the possibility of having just the small number of friends whom you really cared about. And so they sort of, in the end, after a lot of thought, I guess, opted to take the 50 layer, which is the sort of last but one before you get to the 150. And that's sort of, you know, the 50 most important people to you in your real everyday life, and just concentrate on those. And this goes back to the fact that one of the things that sort of started to emerge in Facebook a few years ago is the fact that people were posting stuff up there and kind of, you know, your mum was seeing your pictures of your holiday, which you didn't really want her to see.
Yeah.
And, you know, this sense that there were just too many people having access to your private life, as it were.
So by limiting your friends' network to 50 people on Path, they're trying to create a different experience. Google also
yes.
came out with their priority inbox this year, which sorts your emails by who is more important. So I guess there's some pushback to this idea of a limitless network of friends.
That's right.
Do you think it makes a difference? Is there enough experience yet with Path to kind of set up this call-in that we're going to have that qualitatively, it's different when somebody only has 50 friends than 150 friends? Is the experience of Path different from the experience of Facebook?
I actually don't know. Path was only launched at the beginning of December, I think it was. So it's only been running about a month or so.
Right.
And you really can't tell, I think.
All right. We will continue in just a minute with Robin Dunbar, author of the book, How Many Friends Does One Person Need? Dunbar's Number and Other Evolutionary Quirks. And our lines immediately filled up, Professor Dunbar, when we asked this question about how being Facebook friends affects your face-to-face interaction and does it replicate it or is it really very different? 212-433-WNYC when people finish up. And we'll get to some of those calls and more with Professor Dunbar in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll have the author of the book, The Haves and the Have-Nots, A Brief and Idiosyncratic History of Global Inequality. We'll also talk to the president of a New York City Teamsters local, which represents some New York State public employees, and we'll get their reaction from a public worker perspective to Governor Cuomo's plans. Are public employees being scapegoated in New York and everywhere else? We'll talk about that, among other things, on tomorrow's Brian Lehrer Show. Right now we continue with Robin Dunbar, the evolutionary psychologist and anthropologist, and his book, How Many Friends Does One Person Need? Dunbar's Number and Other Evolutionary Quirks. And the question for you about whether Facebook is a mirror or if it has changed the way you relate to your actual friends. Judith in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you for calling.
Well, I was interested because I'm an artist and I have a very large number. I have about 655 friends.
Mm.
And I think on one hand, it's sort of mirroring professional networking. And on the other hand, coming from a visual population, it's changing the dialogue in person. But it's, you know, somebody asked me, do I think that it's a positive or negative? And I think for me, as sort of an urban dweller, that I spend more time virtually, which is a negative. But I wonder if for people living more suburban or rurally, that maybe this is a positive. This is a way for them to reach out to folks that they otherwise couldn't.
Any reaction to that, Professor Dunbar?
Oh, I'm sure that, you know, if your circumstances, let's say, are such that you can't get out so often. If you think of, you know, perhaps mothers at home with small children and having to, you know, being confined to the house and not able to get out, this, things like Facebook must be a huge advantage in allowing them to keep up with their friends. Because we found that with friends, this doesn't happen with family, that's the interesting thing, but with friends, if you don't contact them on a regular basis, they will slide down the sort of layers, as it were, and drop out of your world within a matter of months, if not, you know, not even years. I mean, it's quite literally a matter of months that they'll gradually begin to fade from you. So you've really got to keep that going. And just being able to do that over long distances, you know, friends in California or some other part of the world, is surely important.
Judith, thank you. And from our Facebook page, Holly writes, Facebook is a digitized reflection of real-life relationships. Acquaintances and friendships exist and evolve in varying degrees, but on Facebook there is an added dimension. One might now know others only through the internet or because of it. Imagine the dynamics to be explored through such interpersonal links. But despite the hopefulness and vision of possibilities in that post, I think Joe in Westchester has a different experience. Hi, Joe.
How you doing today, Brian?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, Brian, I see with my daughter who's now just recently started college, and she's going off Facebook between the demands of Facebook and the texting. And, I mean, I just see that she gets so far removed from just, yeah, being with people. So I've just found it to be extremely unhealthy. And then sometimes some of the stuff that she has posted regarding just some of the family dynamics, I've been shocked.
But is that just your perception from your generation, or do you think she experiences her face-to-face friendships as weak, her ties to her friends as weak because of, technology interaction?
Probably, certainly mine. I'm certainly a more old school in that respect. I'm Italian. There's nothing like a homemade sauce. if you know what I mean.
Yes. Thank you very much. There is a generational perspective that comes into play here, Professor Dunbar. I don't know how much you've looked into this, but I think if you ask 19-year-olds and their parents what their Facebook use is doing to their face-to-face interactions and their emotional relationships with their friends, you'd get very different responses from the parents and from the kids.
That's certainly true, but I'm kind of sympathetic with the caller actually on this, even as another older generation person, as they say. But one of the things I might comment about in relation to how we maintain friendships is there does seem to be a very striking, at least from our data anyway, very striking difference between males and females in this respect. The thing that stops relationships sliding for women is talking together. The thing that stops relationships sliding for blokes, for the men, is doing stuff together. They really have to get out and do stuff together, and being able to sort of, as it were, meet up on Facebook simply isn't good enough in general for men. And I think that's why you see more women using Facebook than you find men using Facebook on the whole.
Yeah, in fact, Facebook found that women tend to have more friends and more direct contact with their friends on the site than men do. And I wonder, is that consistent with Dunbar's number and your research about 150? And I guess I also wonder, is that more evidence that Facebook replicates our social patterns rather than reinvents them?
The answer is yes. In real life, women have slightly bigger social circles than men do. Not hugely so, but, sort of consistently so at all levels. So women have more intimate friends than men have. They have more people at the 50 layer than men have. They have more people in the 150 layer.
Alex in Bay Ridge, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks for calling.
Hi, I was just actually thinking about this discussion. I was just thinking about how it actually limits our, in my opinion, it limits our friendships, because I find that the most important thing about friendships is character. And that's when you know your friends, you know who they are, and you're friends with people that you admire and respect. And I feel that when you have a friendship with people who you only see what they want you to see, it's hard to really establish some kind of connection there.
Thank you for your call. Professor, I mean, this is the debate. And I don't know, I'm guessing, Alex, that you're not a Facebook user also, or a social network user?
No, I just find that it's strange to me, because I surround myself with amazing people, and I feel that it's strange to carry on these discussions with people that I don't really know who they are.
Thank you, Alex. And Ira in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I am 49 years old. I'm a digital immigrant, and I have about 1,350 Facebook friends. And I understand that those friends are not the 150 that Dr. Dunbar is talking about. I think he's absolutely right that the friends, in the classic sense, it's probably about the right number, and I've had roughly that number going in and out of my life over my entire lifetime. But what I've found in the last several years with Facebook is it creates a new layer of connection. Some with my dear friends, my circle of 150, and with people that I'm connected to professionally, people from my past life. My fourth grade best friend found me on Facebook, and we've had a couple of connections. Has he become one of the 150? He has not. But I think what Facebook and its ilk do is give us an opportunity to create another layer of connection to people, which can be very, it doesn't replace the 150, it can be satisfying, it can give us a bigger window into the world that we've been living in. And the other piece is I'm an educator at a synagogue, and we've created a Facebook group that has about 240 of our members who are in it, and people are getting to know one another. People that they only meet at the carpool line are spending more time together and then remarking on it in the Facebook group, which is leading to more connections in face-to-face connections.
Ira, thank you very much. And Daniel in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, Brian. I'd like to say that I don't think Facebook has really changed anything at all. If anything, it's akin to a bar in a small town, which is, I'm from a small town. Everyone you've known or maybe peripherally known in your life happens to be at that bar like the night before Thanksgiving, and you talk to them briefly. You don't say anything important. In fact, you mention things that you never really would say in normal, like FaceTime with friends, like videos and nonsense things. So I don't think Facebook deserves the credit it gets. If anything, I think cell phones deserve the credit for adjusting social relationships.
Daniel, thank you. So, Professor Dunbar, a couple of interesting calls there at the last.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking actually of an example that somebody was telling me not very long ago, where they'd had a couple of, I think they were Brazilian girls working in, for them as au pairs, working in the house, doing childcare for them and staying with them, with the family. And this was in London. And they were absolutely amazed because these girls spent their entire time on Facebook talking to their friends back in Brazil. And there they were sitting in London, in the middle of the opportunity to, if you like, broaden their cultural and social worlds. And they just weren't making use of it because they were stuck on Facebook back in Brazil.
Interesting. And you wonder with Ira's story, particularly about the synagogue group, whether Facebook presents a different opportunity than
sure.
we've had
yep.
over previous history, to actually deepen relationships and deepen relationships among more people rather than just replicate that 150.
Yeah, no, I'm sure in that sort of context it plays a very useful and valuable role. And going back to his 1,300 friends that he had on Facebook, that's actually very close to the upper limit of the number of people whose faces you can recognize and put names to, which is usually about 1,500. So what he's done is pretty much include everybody in that he's kind of ever met at least knows vaguely, and that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do, of course.
We're almost out of time, and I want to make sure that everybody knows that your book, even though it's called How Many Friends Does One Person Need, is not only about Facebook and social networks. You write about so many interesting, what you call other evolutionary quirks. And I'm just going to touch on one other as an example because it's relevant in a way to what's in the news today here in the United States. We know you're in the UK. But one of your pieces is on what makes people laugh. And you may have heard about one of the habits of the new Speaker of the House, John Boehner, who has a tendency to cry in public, as he did again yesterday as he was sworn in as Speaker. So you write about why we laugh, that it helps strengthen social bonds. So why do we cry?
It's a very good question. It's actually a complete mystery because crying seems to be unique to humans. None of the other monkeys and apes do it. The family, animal family to which we belong. As far as we know, no other bird or mammal cries. There's something peculiar to humans, but it seems to be very much tied up in our sort of emotional world, as it were, and sort of designed to try and elicit sympathy and the like. But why the speaker is crying like this, I couldn't imagine.
You want to tell us more about why we laugh?
Well, laughter seems to be very important, and we think it evolved, and again, it's pretty much unique to humans. Apes, particularly chimpanzees, do something very close to what we do, but it's not as exaggerated. And we think what's happened is that capacity, as it were, the apes use it in the context of play, whereas we use it in a much more general social context. And what's happened is we've sort of capitalized on that and expanded it, as it were, in order to create a stronger sense of bonding within large communities of individuals, because the way, you know, the way you sort of build intimate relationships, which is mostly to do with physical touch and so on, it just doesn't allow you to reach the kinds of group sizes, community sizes that we've evolved to manage. And some other mechanism was required to do that. We think that laughter was one of those mechanisms. Music, again, is another. They seem to work extremely well in gelling people and who do these things together into a sort of solid community.
Robin Dunbar, professor of evolutionary anthropology and psychology at Oxford, and now the author of How Many Friends Does One Person Need? Dunbar's Number and Other Evolutionary Quirks. Thank you so much. Will you be my friend on Facebook?
I'm not on Facebook.
Thanks for joining us.
No one told you life was gonna be this way. Your job's a joke, you broke.
It's the Friends theme by the Rembrandts. Talk to you tomorrow. Brian Lehrer and WNYC.